And on The Voice of America, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Good evening. This is The Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Impoga. This evening, we'll discuss how African countries are responding to the COVID-19 pandemic.
And joining me tonight is my colleague, Vincent Macquarie, Managing Editor of VOA Africa 54. Vincent, welcome to the show.
It's a delight. Thank you.
You're very much welcome. And also joining us is regular panelist, Suleiman Mugula, is joining us from Durban, South Africa. And he's an independent political analyst.
As I said, tonight we'll look at the response of African governments to the COVID-19 pandemic. There are well over 10 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 worldwide, and there's been just over 500,000 deaths worldwide so far. Africa has reported just over 400,000 cases, and the five countries reporting most cases are South Africa, Egypt, Nigeria, Ghana, and Algeria. But Nigeria will resume domestic flights from July 8th, according to a statement released by the government on Wednesday. In other countries with very few cases and zero deaths, the lockdown continues.
So, Vincent, let me begin with you. From your vantage point, and there's different African countries have reacted in different ways. What's your general take on the response, generally?
Well, first we have to remember that we actually talked about this issue at the very beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, and we talked about what plans do African countries have. How are they going to manage the situation given the different economic conditions of our people and what how our societies are organized. And what we saw initially is that no country seemed to know what they want to do. They were not clear on what they were supposed to do. So the initial reaction was that this thing does not affect Africans. We are safe. This is only killing Chinese and Europeans and later Americans. And we actually mentioned that during some of our conversations, and we said this is going to be one of the tragedies of the continent, that false belief that it does not affect Africans. Now, eventually, when it looked that it was very clear that this does not discriminate, we saw African countries starting to implement different measures. Those different measures were kind of knee-jerk reactions because they were based on what they were seeing happening in other countries. We had a lockdown. Then later on, I remember like in Kenya, some sudden curfews. They were not so clear about, what social distancing was to mean for communities that are, for example, squeezed together, like those who live in large settlements like Kibera slums. You know, how do you lock down Kibera slums? How do you create social distancing in an environment where people live together like sardines? And then we saw all these measures all the way from South Africa to Tunisia were based on kind of trying to react and copy what was happening in Europe and what was happening in America. And up to this point, it has been almost a trial and error, including the decision on when to resume normalcy, when to go back to school and go back to work. It has been almost like just trying to figure out what is everybody doing. Now, I don't know where Mohula is, if you can tell us. South Africa somehow took some measures, and it looks like they've been having some vibrant, really debate on what to do about the economy, what to do about children going back to school, and even healthcare. I don't know if they had a more sophisticated plan, but as I could tell, in many of the African countries, there was so much of reacting to situations without having had a great plan on how to deal with it.
Yes, Suleiman, since you're on the ground in South Africa went almost to the extreme at the beginning, locking even liquor stores and cigarette, no selling of cigarettes and that kind of stuff. First of all, how is the situation now and how do you assess the reaction, the response?
From the South African side, South Africa, like any other country, there was the initial shock. And the initial reaction was to take control of the situation before it goes out of hand, which, as outlined and recommended by WHO, it included the lockdown, which was done. It was done like in any other country, but like in other African countries, South Africa took long to realize the consequences of the lockdown. And then soon it realized the situation which had been brought about by the social and economic consequences that came out of that, and then it started taking response. Of course, it is a well-resourced country. It came up with a very big budget of almost 10% of the budget as relief measures. It included the initiatives in social welfare. Already it has got a running social welfare program. It lifted it up. It increased the money which it gives to the vulnerable. It created an unemployment fund for about 3 months. It created an emergency fund where people could contribute and then help other sources. There were lots of interferences which they did. In other words, while they were reacting to the pandemic, they were also reacting to the social and economic crisis that had come together with the pandemic. So theirs was a big, here ours was a big focus, and it is still focused, though it is going out of hand because it has overstayed, and the social and economic crisis is overrunning the government space because the suffering has started pitching in, the unemployment, the loss of jobs, and so on and so forth. On the continent, if I would come out from South Africa, I think one can safely say the pandemic has been an acid test for the leadership in Africa. We have been able to see where we have banana republics and where we have fully-fledged governments with working institutions. Those who have got fully-fledged government with working institutions, when they overcame the initial shock, they were able to settle down and sit on both the pandemic and then the social and economic crisis. Those with leadership, countries like Ethiopia were able to sit and internalize the problem and be able to assess the problem and find out whether if they put the measures recommended by WHO, they'll be able to fit in. And the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, together with his government, they ably decided that the conditions given by WHO would not fit into Ethiopia. The government came up with a policy straight clear that they could not lock down because of various reasons. One, they could not, people don't have places where they were, houses where they are to be locked up. Two, in those who have houses, they survive from hand to mouth. Three, he said the country was too poor to stop the population from moving. The economy could not manage it. Therefore, they just customized their regulations and found a way of how to handle the situation, but without locking down. Then you move to other countries also. Kenya also did well. It was able to. Kenya, I think, was the best because by the time the president came up, he had a number of interventions in the social and economic sector, and also in the pandemic sector. So his was well organized, taxes reduced, VAT reduced, everything you can think of to revive the economy and to make sure that people don't go into starvation and the economy doesn't sink immediately. Then another one also, I think Ghana also came with a good. And then we have got those who are totally blind. Countries like Burundi, they never bothered. Maybe they assessed the situation. Tanzania never bothered. Maybe they assessed the situation. Then there was confusion in countries like Uganda, where they just did a copy and paste of lockdown, stupid lockdown, very tight, and then without any direction of where they were going. I think up to today, countries like Uganda have not even come up with a direction of what has to be done in the circumstances which we are in.
I see. Vicent, Suleiman has gone in detail some, in some countries looking at the different responses. Tanzania, President Magufuli said they dismissed the whole thing and left, carried on as normal. He hasn't lost, he hasn't had, well, maybe he's not giving out the figures, but the situation doesn't be as bad as elsewhere. It's almost the same. As he says, exactly. Uganda's motto is, I don't know, nobody understands it. So what's your general take on the response of various countries around the continent?
I think we can say that just like it was in the first few weeks where there was no single case reported in Africa, and for a moment we were taking comfort in that there's some kind of connection with the weather that made Africa be spared, and perhaps we will not be touched by it. That happened to have been pure chance at that time, and perhaps just because of the interaction initially, it wasn't as much. Some countries have had just the kind of, we could say, a little bit of a chance, or lack, as you could say, where they didn't take as serious measures as they ought to have taken, and somehow they appear to be doing not as badly. Now, an example is Tanzania. But then when you go and try to find out what is happening internally, you're told that there have been so many people infected, there have been cases of death that have not been reported. You have to remember that some of these countries, like Tanzania, have muzzled the media. There's no freedom of reporting. You cannot question or demand to be given numbers of infections and deaths. If you do that, you will be either shut down or somehow they have a way to make sure that you will never get that kind of information. Now, one of the things, of course, that also comes out of this is that how accurate have been, and I'm not trying to poo-poo the measures that have been taken by different governments, and that I'm not trying to imagine that there are many cases in Uganda than in other countries that are reporting or in Tanzania. But I'm saying one of the missing things in some of these countries is transparency. I mean, we've seen Kenya where they are actually updating you on the infections and the deaths every day. Tanzania decided they're not going into that business. Now, the question is it really true that there are not as many infections and that people are not dying? Or is it that, because of not wanting, being in denial and not wanting to go back on the initial disposition that they will not take those measures, and feeling the embarrassment of acknowledging that there could be a problem, that there could be actually many infections and people dying, and that information being kind of kept tight by the government. We don't know. So what's going on in Uganda? We have some kind of an idea, but at the same time, some of the information you find that is kind of tightly held by the authorities. So I can say that when you look across the continent, some countries may not seem to be as seriously affected, perhaps because of just some chance, and again because so many of the other countries, implemented lockdowns and no travel, and so it could happen that some of these countries, by the time the lockdowns were in place, nobody was traveling to those countries to possibly spread any of that disease over there, and because of that, they were spared. But again, when you look at a country like Kenya, which has done amazingly well, but then every day they're updating you of infections. They're updating infections, but those infections are based on tests. In all the African countries, my question has been, how many people have actually been tested? How many people that are dying do we know if they're dying from COVID-19 or any other diseases, given that some of our countries, people live in some remote regions where nobody's reporting. Someone is dying out in the village there. Nobody knows how they died. People may be sick and perhaps not very seriously sick. They may recover, but we don't know if they got COVID because nobody tested them. Of course, there have been so many, there's been a lot of help from people like Jack Ma, the Chinese, helping African countries to get testing kits. But quite a number of countries, I think, may not have done sufficient testing to establish how many people have been infected, how many people have healed from those infections, and how many people have died. We don't know if we have the accurate number. I personally hope and pray that it's a minimal number, because I really don't want Africans to die from this disease. But I still have my reservations about the accuracy of the numbers because of the nature of our you know, the nature of some of the countries in terms of freedom of information.
See, now for those just joining us, this is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Reporters Roundtable. We are coming to you live from Washington, and my panelists are Suleiman Mgula, an independent political analyst, and my colleague Vincent Macaulay, VOA's Africa 54 managing editor, and we're talking about the response by various African governments to the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, Suleiman, a crucial issue is that in most African countries, take aside South Africa maybe and a few North African countries, the health infrastructure is so poor. Even when talking of testing, they don't have the capacity to test even. They didn't even have capacity if the worst had come to the worst to handle the patients. Does it surprise you that Africa has so far at least not had it bad enough? Or as Vincent says, maybe we don't know what's going on.
I agree with Vincent 100%. We don't know what is going on. We don't know what is happening. As you are saying, one of the biggest problems with this pandemic is that if it finds with the underlying condition, the probability of your survival is so limited. Unfortunately, most of our health services had underlying conditions. They were sick themselves already. They were inefficient. So right now, when this came, they don't have the capacity. Apart from South Africa, which is coming to almost 1 million, which is also still low, and then Kenya over is going into almost 100,000, Ghana almost 100,000. The other countries, they are still in 1,000 or below 1,000 tests. That cannot give us a good picture for a country with 47 million people, and then you have only tested 1,000 people. So if you are giving those figures mean nothing. And then the way Vincent has said, we don't know whether people are dying in the rural areas because the lockdown pushed, locked out the country stupidly in most of these countries like Uganda, like all these copy and paste who did the lockdown. They just locked down. Even people with chronic diseases, they didn't open up the health centers. They just locked up everybody. So we don't know whether people are dying or which figures they are giving are really correct. Maybe people are dying, but we expect that maybe the infections are still going on, and we are yet to see more infections and more deaths, which will be bad for this continent. We are crossing our fingers. The continent should cross its fingers. We don't know what is going on. If we survive the pandemic, we shall not survive the other chronic diseases because they were also neglected. Most of the governments never gave attention to the fact that there were other chronic diseases which were in the society and which the poor health services of the countries were struggling with. So we still have a long way to go. We are yet to see the disaster coming.
I see. Vincent, some people and commentators have pointed out the not so straightforward warnings from WHO. You remember, first of all, they said the virus couldn't be transmitted by human to human. Then they said people should not lock their countries, they should keep them open. Then they said later lock. Then they said face masks were not useful. Then they said use them. Were those confusing messages also a factor in how some African countries responded?
They were a very big factor. And they were a very big factor. And I think they were also confusing to WHO itself, because I think the disease came in a way and at a speed in which at which they were not able to establish for sure what the disease could do to a human being. and therefore they could not establish the best measures to take. But they were kind of they were trying to rush to help. They were like firefighters rushing to extinguish a fire, and they arrive there to find that the nature of the fire does not require water. You need foam. You need some kind of a different agent. The disease came with a lot of unknowns. There was a lot of learning curve, actually several learning curves. And that's why I don't blame the WHO entirely, because I think they were just trying their best. But all the information they were getting from their experts, from the scientists, it was in kind of, in a way, misinforming them, because it was based on a level of ignorance. Everybody was trying to learn. We've seen this take so many cycles, even here in the U.S., including even a U.S. expert here, CDC. They were telling us one thing, and after several months, they tell you something else to do with the masks, to do with hand washing and sanitizing and all that. So those messages, indeed, were confusing. I don't think they were malicious. I don't think the WHO intended to mislead anybody. But the WHO could not come out and acknowledge initially that we don't know everything about this disease. There have been a few experts who have said we do not know everything about this disease, including, remember, the first time initial stages were telling us it does not touch children. It does not affect people who are 50 years and below. And then later on they say, oh no, the children are dying. People who are 50 are dying, you know. So I think the disease caught us by surprise. It did not give us time to learn about it. And so those messages confused everybody. And I think they are also responsible for quite a number of the infections that started spreading even across Africa.
I see. Now, briefly, Suleiman, at least this, some countries have begun easing up a little bit on the lockdown. And Africa, as you know, and our listeners know, is so amorphous. The boundaries are so, I mean, it's easy to cross from one country to the other. If the lockdown is released further and people begin crisscrossing the continent, do you think maybe, I don't know, what do you see coming, briefly?
It is a tricky situation as far as the pandemic is concerned. It is still confusing, as you are saying, but one factor has to be established. The disease is here, and it's not going soon, and it doesn't have any treatment whatsoever or a vaccine. So that is why so many countries have realized that it is meaningless as of now to continue locking down people, because it is not going tomorrow. That is why in South Africa, at least for the last 2 days, we have just started easing the children from going back to school, though the infection rate is increasing. The number of infected people is increasing rapidly. But the fact of the matter is that the pandemic is here to stay. The disease is here to stay. People just have to learn how to live with it. The only fact which we cannot, which we are not confused about, is the social and economic effects of the pandemic. It is only countries which don't have leadership that don't recognize that there is an economic crisis which has hit all the countries. That one is undisputable.
I see. Vincent, briefly, how do you see things working out? Because it can go one of two ways. Either the people, things are okay and things are go ahead, or maybe some second wave, as people say.
This is my fear. I'm one of those who fear for a second wave. And I'm one of those who fear that the second wave could be the African wave, could be the African tragedy. And the reason is, one, we do not have elaborate medical infrastructure. We do not have the economic wherewithal in a number of the countries to deal with a massive, massive increase of this. Look at how many hospitals do we have, how many ventilators do we have across the continent. Just because we've been spared, for whatever reason, that at this time we're not seeing hundreds of thousands just dropping dead every day. But the virus still stays. We do not know if there will be, as some experts have warned, a second wave, and that perhaps the second wave now will come at a time when we have let our guards down. We go back to work, to go to business, go back to our marketplaces. And then once it starts rolling, it starts spreading across the continent, what do we do then? So I just fear. I know that the economies cannot be left to be stagnant forever. People must resume back to work. It does not preclude the fear that it's a possibility. The second wave, there could be a second wave, and it could hit Africa hardest. I just hope it doesn't happen. I really hope and pray it doesn't happen. But I do fear that that could be a possibility.
Suleiman, we have another 30 seconds left. South Africa being what it is, and that's where you are, it attracts a lot of, it attracts a lot of Africans from other African countries. What's the plan for the country? Are they going to be strict on allowing in fellow Africans in later, or what do you think? Briefly, very briefly.
No, the borders are still locked. Mm-hmm. We're not allowing in anybody. We are dealing with a pandemic. The latest figure shows they're scary, because one of the provinces, Western Cape, is being inundated soon. We are a resourced country. We are setting up emergency beds, but the numbers are increasing. We are so scared about Africa, given its weak position and corruption. I know the international communities has already started giving money, IMF, World Bank, and so on. They are pouring in money in these corrupt countries, but they are going to steal that money. But should the worst comes, one wouldn't like to know what will happen to the continent.
I see. Vicent, 10 seconds. Travel in Africa after this. How, do you think there'll be a change?
I think it's going to change a lot. I have to say very quickly that inevitably this thing, COVID-19, has changed the culture of how we interact, how we sanitize ourselves. I think people are going to be more cautious about washing their hands, taking precautions, and being a little bit careful about around people who are, looking sick, coughing, and also people are going to fairly be careful about how they interact with people when they're in a more crowded area, especially when you're crossing from one country to another, not knowing what's going on. So it will change. It will change the way we interact and the way we do things, in public.
Well, that wraps up this edition of Reporters Roundtable. Thanks to my colleague, Vincent Makori, Managing Editor, VOA's Africa 54, and Suleiman Mgula, an independent political analyst based in Durban, South Africa. Gentlemen, thanks very much for being on the show.
We will be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. And in case you missed any or part of this program, you can still access it by going to our main website at voanews.com, click on Programs, and scroll down to Reporters Roundtable. Once again, thanks for joining us tonight. I'm your host, Douglas Mpuga, wishing you all the best.
To a panel of prominent Washington journalists deliberate the latest top news stories around the world. Join moderator Michael Williams as he leads a discussion with panelists Emily Tamkin and Richard Laundress on President Trump disputing a report about Russian bounties. This and other stories on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi there, this is Lori London, host of VOA's International Edition. Join me weekdays at 3:30, 4:30, and 5:30 UTC for the big stories facing our world. From Africa to the Americas and every place in between, we've got you covered with the latest news and information. You'll also hear